The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the September-October issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to start with Who's Who. That'll be found on page 8, line 1. Dylan DeLucia, Ole Miss Rebels pitcher. His height is 6'1". His weight is 205 pounds. He was born August 1st, 2000, hometown, Port Orange, Florida. After allowing just one run in 16 and two-thirds innings, DeLucia was named Most Outstanding Player of the 2022 College World Series, which Ole Miss won. He finished his junior season with an 8-2 record and a 3.68 ERA. He was drafted by Cleveland in the sixth round. Did you know the Rebels' 2022 national title was their first officially recognized championship in any men's sport, though the school claimed football titles in 1959, 1960, and 1962. Next, we have Micah Parsons, his Dallas Cowboys linebacker. His height is 6'3". His weight is 245 pounds. He was born May 26, 1999, in his hometown, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. After playing middle linebacker in college at Penn State, Parsons moved to the outside as a rookie and became one of the NFL's best pass rushers. He had 13 sacks, the third most ever by a first-year player, and was named NFL Defensive Rookie of the Year. Did you know, though, that Parsons is an avid chess player? Before his rookie season, he said he wants to be the queen of linebackers, referring to the strongest piece on the chessboard. And finally, we have Andrew Wiggins, Golden State Warriors guard. His height is 6'7". His weight is 197 pounds. He was born February 23, 1995, in his hometown, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. In his eighth NBA season, Wiggins made his first All-Star appearance. He averaged 17.2 points per game, the lowest since his rookie year, but was an excellent role player as the Warriors won the NBA title. Wiggins led Golden State with 26 points in a key Game 5 finals win over the Celtics. Did you know only two Canadian players have been the top pick in the NBA draft? Anthony Bennett and Wiggins. They were taken in consecutive years, 2013 and 2014, by the same team, the Cavaliers. Let's go now to warm-up. Kip answers your questions. Leroy writes, "Hey, Kip, I know most professional sports teams have mascots, and I was wondering who your favorite mascots are." Hey, Levi, I really shouldn't reveal a ranking this important on the letters page. I feel like my top five mascots could easily fill up 2 to 4 pages in the back of the magazine. In fact, I can't believe they didn't pick me for pages 46 and 47. Players with the same name? We may be running out of ideas. Anyway, I gravitate toward the mascots that don't make any sense or fit the team concept at all. Philly Fanatic, Phoenix Suns Gorilla, Stanford Tree, Yuppie, 5, Western Kentucky Big Red. Patrick writes, "I think that errors should not be given as often in the Major League Baseball. Just the other day, I saw an MVP candidate track down a foul ball toward the stands, reach over the fence, and drop it. He was charged with an error when really any other player couldn't have made the play look easy." I appreciate you protecting the identity of the MVP candidate who dropped the ball, Patrick. That shows your commitment to not taking errors seriously, and you shouldn't. Errors, after all, only treasures a fielder's ability to catch the balls they reach. But it's more important to get to balls in the first place. That emphasis has led to holistic fielding stats like ultimate zone rating and total zone runs. According to Total Zone Runs, Orioles third baseman Brooks Robinson prevented more opposing scoring through his fielding than any other player in history, 293 runs. He also made 264 errors and the Hall of Fame. Simone writes, if Steph Curry played in the 80s or 90s, would he still be as dominant as he is now? Simone, you're asking the tough questions. It's hard for me to imagine Curry in the 80s or 90s. In fact, it's hard for me to imagine the 80s or 90s at all. The problem with sending a trailblazing player back in time is how close-minded the coaches would be. In the 80s, Curry wouldn't have been allowed to shoot 600 threes a season. In the 90s, he'd be good, but maybe not the primary scoring option. Just imagine Curry passing up open trays to throw the ball to Shaq in the low post. Send your questions to Kip at kip.shoremore@si.com. Future Stars, page 14. Nazir Primus, birthplace Brooklyn, New York. Birth date, January 19, 2008. Sport, fencing. Nazir Primus loves the mental aspect of fencing, which he compares to a physical form of chess. And his mind was where it needed to be in July when he won the Youth 14 Sabre Division at USA Fencing National Championships. Nazir picked up fencing 4 years ago after his uncle introduced it to him and now trains at New York's Peter Westbrook Foundation. Most kids my age would be playing basketball, football, soccer, Nazir says. I like how I stand out. Are you a sports kid? If you think you have what it takes to be a sports kid of the month, have an adult submit your nomination at sportskid@si.com. Warm up, fun with math. The rest is yet to come. The infinite monkey theorem holds that if given infinite time, a bunch of monkeys randomly banging typewriters would eventually write the complete works of William Shakespeare. You may remember in the March-April issue when Buzz tried to leverage this theory to use teams of baseball-playing primates to create new what's-the-call scenarios. Professional sports feel like they've been going on forever. They played Major League Baseball in 1876, but in the grand scheme of things, they're quite new. Every play that could happen hasn't quite happened. How do we know? Things are still happening. Football fans who follow the account at NFL.scorigami on Twitter understand. The account posts when there's a scorigami, a combination of score and origami, a result that's never occurred before in the NFL. Sports writer John Weiss introduced the concept and coined the term in an attempt to chart every final score that hadn't yet happened. With football, in which points typically come in multiples of 3 and 7, certain scores really stick out. And the Twitter bot even gives updated odds during games of a scorigami occurring. Once a defense records a safety or a couple of extra points get flubbed, the real excitement begins. The most recent such game, the 1,702nd, was Cowboys 51, Eagles 26 in January. The board on the opposite page shows which scores are still possible. Don't expect it to fill up anytime soon. A team finishing with just 1 point is technically possible, but highly unlikely, thanks to a rule about safeties on point after attempts. Scorigami in sports that happen in 1 point increments are obviously much rarer. During their July 22nd drubbing of the Red Sox, the Blue Jays seemed destined for a scorigami, but the game finished 28-5. A scorigami in the NFL, but not in Major League Baseball. Still, unique outcomes happen in baseball. On July 4th, the Minnesota Twins turned the first 8-5 triple play. That's center fielder to third baseman, not the score, in Major League Baseball history. With Chicago White Sox runners on first and second, Byron Buxton made an over-the-shoulder catch at the wall, then threw the ball back to Gio Urshela, who tagged the trailing runner before getting the lead runner out by stepping on second. So, keep watching and keep reading. Eventually, this magazine will print Shakespeare or something just as good. Game plans, tanking, trading, drafting, having a lot of money. In the Big Four men's sports, there are plenty of ways to put together a title-worthy team, but none of them are easy, and they're certainly not foolproof. Picture here of Joe Burrow and the Cincinnati Bengals attempting a pass. NFL, if you want to win, you need a quarterback. How you get him is a whole other question. Just 4 years ago, Joe Burrow was living a pretty normal existence. Sure, he was a quarterback for a major college football program, LSU, but it's not like he was being mobbed by fans everywhere he went. He'd been a backup at Ohio State before transferring to LSU. When he walked from Tiger Stadium across the street to his car, it was a peaceful stroll. A year later, that same walk became so perilous that Burrow considered hiring a full-time bodyguard. The reason was simple. LSU was in the midst of a nation's title run, and when something like that happens, the focus of the fans always turned to one player, the quarterback. It is definitely the most important position in football, and arguably the most important in all of sports. In the modern NFL, the team without an elite quarterback has no chance to win the Super Bowl. The quarterbacks who have done it recently are among the best to have ever played. Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Peyton Manning, Drew Brees. Even the teams who have been able to win without a future Hall of Famer under center have relied on a quarterback having a monster season, such as Carson Wentz of the Eagles and Joe Flacco of the Ravens. So after Burrow's senior season, in which he threw for 60 touchdowns and just 6 interceptions and won the Heisman Trophy, the Bengals jumped at the chance to select him with the first pick in the draft. Burrow was immediately hailed as a savior and the title star of Cincinnati. He tried as hard as he could to stay grounded and out of the spotlight. He kept up a routine in which he had a regular video game night with his old friend from Athens High. As they played Star Wars Battlefront 2 on Xbox Live, Burrow was just one of the guys. His buddies had no problem poking fun at him, reminding Burrow that in their eyes he wasn't an NFL superstar. They'd adopt a goofy voice and say, "Ooh, look at me, big Mr. Quarterback." But as Cincinnati's fortunes improved on the field, it became harder for Burrow to be anything but Mr. Quarterback. Heck, even the kicker was appearing on billboards last year, so you can imagine how hard it was for Burrow to go outside without being mobbed. The Bengals' season culminated with a run to Super Bowl 56, just the third time the franchise had reached the big game. They lost to the Rams 23-20, but their performance sent a message that Cincinnati is going to be a handful for years to come. Burrow's star turn in his second season more than justified the team's decision to take him first. Cincinnati was able to build a system that allowed him to shine. Burrow is an incredibly accurate passer with a quick release, so the Bengals installed a spread offense that gave him just enough time to deliver the ball to an open receiver. Protection was an issue. Burrow was sacked 70 times last year, counting the postseason. So close. Just 1 year after a 4-win season, Cincinnati and Burrow came within 85 seconds of the franchise's first Super Bowl victory. Trading. And his rookie year was cut short by a knee injury suffered when he was hit by a crew of Washington pass rushers. But Burrow was still able to make it work, because more often than not, he was able to find his playmakers in time. Still, that underscores one of the dangers of building a system around an untested young quarterback. What if you draft a guy, construct a scheme that fits his strengths, and it turns out when he's under the gun, he's just not very good? Now, if you want to bring in another quarterback, you're likely going to be trying to force a square peg into a round hole. And what if you don't have the pieces to put together the kind of supporting cast he needs? That's a recipe for disaster, at least in the short term. Consider this. As a rookie, Burrow didn't have an elite wideout to throw to. The Bengals were just 2-7-1 when Burrow got hurt. They staggered home to a 4-11-1 finish. That was bad enough to get them the fifth pick in the draft, which they used on Jamar Chase, a wide receiver from LSU. The first three picks were not surprisingly quarterbacks. Burrow's old Tigers teammate went on to catch 81 passes for 1,455 yards. A similar thing happened to Peyton Manning. The first pick in the 1998 draft, he struggled mightily with the Colts as a rookie, throwing 28 interceptions for an Indianapolis team that finished 3-13. With the fourth pick in the draft after three quarterbacks, of course, the Colts were able to select running back Edgerrin James, who went on to become a Hall of Famer. Indy went 13-3 the next year. That could give Jacksonville fans reason to feel optimistic. In 2021, the Jags took Trevor Lawrence first, the 18th time in 24 years that a quarterback was the top pick. He had a horrid rookie season, and Jacksonville finished 3-14, allowing the team to pick first again. The Jags took edge rusher Trayvon Walker. That move might not send Jacksonville straight to the Super Bowl, but it will make the team substantially better in the long run. And building around a young quarterback can be a long, bumpy process. Trading for a quarterback, still on page 39. The team Burrow and his Bengals lost to in the Super Bowl 56 took the opposite path to finding its quarterback. The Rams went out and got him. Los Angeles tried the draft and nurture method, selecting Jared Goff first in 2016, sacrificing two first-round picks to move up to get him. Goff was solid in his first three seasons, but began to slide in 2020 as the Rams' defense flourished. Meanwhile, in Detroit, the Lions and longtime quarterback Matthew Stafford, below the top pick in the 2009 draft, decided a change of scenery would benefit both parties. So Detroit traded him to the Rams for Goff, who two first-round picks and a third-rounder. The price for Los Angeles paid was heavy, but the deal made sense. The Rams were on the verge of Super Bowl contention and needed an upgrade at quarterback. Would the same deal have made sense for, say, the 6-11 Bears? No, because they'd need so much more than a quarterback, and giving away draft capital would make it harder to build a roster. Acquiring an elite quarterback is not easy. Teams that have them aren't likely to give them up. When one becomes available, it's usually because the player and his team feel like they've gone as far as together as they can. In 2020, Tom Brady decided he'd done enough with the Patriots and became a free agent. He signed a two-year deal worth at least $50 million guaranteed with a team on the cusp of contention, the Buccaneers. That underscored another difficulty in acquiring a star signal caller. It's expensive, but it paid dividends as Tampa won the Super Bowl in Brady's first season. So keep an eye this year on the Colts. After finishing 9-8 last season with Carson Wentz under center, Indy traded for longtime Falcons quarterback Matt Ryan. The four-time Pro Bowler with nearly 60,000 career passing yards was available after Atlanta decided it needed to go in a new direction. Since the Falcons seemed desperate to move on from him, the price was reasonable, just a third-round pick, giving the Colts a massive upgrade while allowing them to improve at other positions. The hope is simple. Repeat what the Rams and Bucks did and pray a living legend will thrive in new surroundings. NHL fans and players hate tanking, but the results are undeniable. The Motor City Assembly Line. You can buy a shirt online that says, "Keep calm and trust in the Iyzer plan," or one that says, "Believe in the Iyzer plan." For Red Wing fans, the Iyzer plan, a portmanteau of general manager Steve Yzerman and plan, gives hope, even confidence, after six straight seasons without a playoff berth. They trust the Iyzer plan because he led the team to three Stanley Cups as a player and, more importantly, built up a Tampa Bay Lightning organization that just appeared in three consecutive Stanley Cup finals. The fans in Detroit are encouraged for another simpler reason. They're not average anymore. They're genuinely bad. In the three seasons before hiring Yzerman, the Red Wings hovered around 30 wins. In the three campaigns before that, they lost in the first round. Yzerman's first Red Wings team in 2019-2020 went 17-49-5. Often in the NHL, to become good, you have to first be bad. Tanking now exists in every sport to various extents, but the NHL's incentive to lose remains the strongest. Unlike the other three major North American men's pro leagues, the NHL has a hard salary cap. A rich owner in Toronto can't pay a luxury tax to spend more money, and Colorado doesn't get to use bird rights to keep Nathan MacKinnon and Cale Maker happy. So teams' windows of contention are smaller, and the cycle of winning and rebuilding more pronounced. The nature of the sport also makes the lottery draft picks, especially the top three, especially valuable. Speed and skill will win championships. Elite offensive hockey talents emerge sooner and peak younger. Google the last 20 years of number one picks in the Major League Baseball draft. How many look like future Hall of Famers? Probably just Bryce Harper. But from the same list for the NHL, Fleury, Ovechkin, Crosby, Kane, Stamkos, Tavares, MacKinnon, McDavid, etc., it'd be easier to list the guys who won't get enshrined. Another name seemingly destined to join that list is Regina Pat's center, Connor Bedard, the presumptive top pick in next year's draft. Bedard is such a sure thing that the Chicago Blackhawks dismantled their entire team this offseason for a chance to pick him. The Blackhawks were not good last year, 28-42-12. At the draft, however, they declared their intention, like the Red Wings 3 years ago, to get a lot worse and fast. Unfortunately, some of their highest-paid older players would be difficult to move in a salary cap league, so they shocked the hockey world by instead dealing their inexpensive, talented young players, 24-year-old Alex DeBrincat and 21-year-old Kirby Dach, for draft picks. Trading a proven young scorer like DeBrincat to acquire unproven young scorers may seem foolish, but there's a logic to it. The players like the Blackhawks draft this year and next will inherit a team with a clean cap sheet, no longer devoting more than a quarter of its payroll to two aging superstars in Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane. After all, it was a good fortune of having the number three and number one picks in 2000 and 2006 and 2007 that allowed the Blackhawks to get Toews and Kane to win three Stanley Cups in the previous decade. The most important factor in building a contender these days is timing. Game plans continued. Major League Baseball. You don't have to be rich in baseball, but it sure helps. Cost of being boss. Look at the Major League Baseball standings at most points this past season. It was hard not to notice that the three best teams, the Dodgers, Mets, and Yankees, reside in the United States' two biggest cities. Though the Houston Astros in the mix and the four most dominant teams were each from one of the country's four most populous areas. Baseball, the only North American sport without a salary cap, is starting to look like European soccer, in which the richest markets attract the richest owners who pay for the best players. It didn't used to be this way. As recently as 2010, the Mets and Dodgers were in fourth place, and the Yankees lost out in the American League East to the Tampa Bay Rays, whose opening day payroll, $72 million, was less than half of New York's $206 million. The big market teams were in flux. The Dodgers owners, Frank and Janie McCourt, had just begun divorce proceedings. Yankees boss George Steinbrenner died that summer, leaving the team to his children. And Mets owner Fred Wilpon's finances were uncertain after having hundreds of millions of dollars tied up in Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Since then, the Dodgers sold to an ownership group led by Lakers legend Magic Johnson, and billionaire Steve Cohen bought the Mets. The top three payrolls in baseball, the Dodgers, $265 million, Mets, $261 million, and the Yankees, $251 million. Baseball's bi-coastal realignment, however, is not just a question of more money, but smarter money. In the early 90s, the Mets and Yankees spent aggressively and got middling to disastrous results. Small market teams could gain an advantage in player evaluation and development. But the rosters of baseball's new big three are littered with homegrown stars. Aaron Judge, Pete Alonso, Clayton Kershaw. Complemented by can't-miss superstar free agents like Garrett Cole, Max Scherzer, and Freddie Freeman. All three teams resisted the urge to raise their farm systems to pursuit of Juan Soto. After all, there's still hope Soto will become a free agent one day when he'll just cost money, of which they have plenty. Baseball's always been rigged and rigged. The rich teams are just getting smarter about rigging it. The wildest card yet. While baseball's franchises become more unequal, the league has pushed the playoff format to be more egalitarian. The prospect of three teams spending five times the cheapest franchise's payroll would be more dire for most of baseball's history when the playoffs consisted of just two of four teams. Under the new collective bargaining agreement, 12 teams qualify for a four-round playoff. There weren't 12 teams this season with a 26-man payroll above $100 million. So, inevitably, at least the mid-to-small-market team will make the tournament. And baseball's playoffs are notoriously a crapshoot. The best teams prevail over 162 games, but in a 3, 5, or 7-game series, a hot pitching staff can pull an upset. That team, the New York franchises, quintupled in spending this season. It was the Baltimore Orioles, who spent most of the season in wild card contention. End zone. Number one, quite the pickle. Penny and Kip are playing pickleball at the SI Kids Treehouse. After they satisfy the two-bounce rule, Kip hits a drop shot into the non-valley zone, the kitchen, on Penny's side of the net. Then, in an attempt to pressure Penny on the return, Kip runs into the kitchen, standing as close to Penny as possible without going over the net. Penny tries to hit the ball past Kip, but it lands out of bounds. Penny claims it should be her point, since Kip was standing in the non-volley zone when her return crossed the net. What's the call? Kip gets the point. A player can enter the non-volley zone at any time as long as they are not in the act of volleying. Next we have the Pirate score. The Pennsylvania Pirates are playing the Vermont Vikings in baseball under Major League Baseball rules. The Pirates have the bases loaded with their leadoff hitter, Annette, up to bat with a full count and one out. Annette socks the 3-2 pitch, but Mary, the Vikings' third baseman, leaps and catches the ball in the air. The runners were in motion, and shortly after Mary catches the ball, the runner on third base crosses the plate. Mary tags a runner from second, now running to third, ending the inning. The Vikings return to the dugout thinking they've escaped a jam, but the umpires rule that the Pirates runner who reached home scored a run. The Vikings protest that she never tagged up. Are the umps right? The answer? The run counts. The umps are correct. Even though the runner on third did not tag up and the Vikings made three outs, Mary must step on third and appeal to the umpire to call the fourth out on the runner who was on third to nullify the run. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.